This is Frank Williams, the vicar, the Reverend Timothy Farthing, welcoming you to this podcast. Not that I know what a podcast is, but enjoy it anyway.
Thank you very much.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run? We are the boys who will stop your little game.
I now have the great honour of being joined by Frank Williams, who of course played the vicar, or to give him his full title, the Reverend Timothy Farthing, in Dad's Army. Hello Frank, thank you for joining us.
It's great, yes. You know, the Reverend Timothy Farthing came about when we were doing the episode where there was a court case, and they suddenly had to call me as a witness, and they couldn't really say call the vicar, so they suddenly had to invent a name for me.
Right.
And that's how it came about. Up to then I was just the vicar.
That was A Brush with the Law, I think.
Oh, it must have been, that's right, yes. Yeah, I forgot the title of it, but yes, A Brush with the Law.
Did you have any input into the name at all?
I don't think I did, no, I didn't. I don't know whether they thought of anything else before Timothy Farthing, but Timothy Farthing they came up with on that day, and it stuck ever since.
It's stuck ever since, great. Okay, well, going back to the very beginning, I mean, when was it that you actually became aware you wanted to be an actor?
Oh, when I was a small boy, actually. I used to dragoon all my friends into being in shows that I'd written, and we used to perform them in the drawing room at home, and all the neighbours would come in and watch and pay penny or tuppence or something towards some wartime charity, and I'd do my thing with all my friends. I mean, as I say, they were dragooned into it. I said, you've got to come and be in my show.
So you were the writer, director of these early productions?
Writer, director, you name it, I did it. The other thing I was really keen on as a boy, I think I was always sort of into show business in a way, learning lots of conjuring tricks and doing card tricks and so on. And so I think I was always a little bit of a performer, which is a bit strange actually, because I was a very shy boy in many ways, but performing, I sort of overcame my shyness in a sense.
There's something actually I've heard in the past where some very well-known, very famous people say, well, really, I'm very shy, and nobody believes them.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I think a lot of people, you see, you sort of lose yourself in the character you're playing, and then you don't have to be yourself. But as yourself, you're shy.
Yeah.
But if your character is a sort of fairly extrovert, well, then you can be fairly extrovert.
No, indeed, yeah. You've always been based in London.
I've lived in North London all my life. I've only ever lived in two houses, to be honest. The one I live in now and my parents' house. So, there you are, I'm a real stick in the mud. Both in the same bit of North London.
But your schooling moved you on a little bit. It moved you from London to Ardingly when you were 12 years old?
When I was 12 years old, I went to Ardingly. It's Ardingly, actually. Ardingly, in Sussex, you always make it lie at the end.
Lie, okay.
A lot of people say Ardingly, but it's a Sussex thing to pronounce the L-Y, an L-Y at the end with a lie.
Oh.
So I'm told, anyway, it's Ardingly. And, I went there, a boarding school, very Spartan, wartime, rationing, a lot of cold water. I remember, I think we had one of the coldest winters ever when I was at school. 1945 or 46, I should think it would be. Everything froze, and we had to carry buckets of water around, I remember, to flush the loos and things like that.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, different life, really.
Yeah.
Did you get much of a chance at school to perform?
Not really, no. In an extraordinary sort of way, I didn't. I mean, it was something I always wanted to do. And as I said, I'd done it at home when I was younger. I remember when I was at Ardingly, we had an inter-dormitory competition of drama. I wasn't invited to be part of our dormitory's offering. One of the people who was there at the same time as I was Billy Cotton Jr., who became very senior in the BBC, and his dormitory did a sort of pastiche of radio programmes at the time. But I was really a bit fed up that I didn't get a chance to be in our dormitory's offering. Later I went to a local grammar school, and right at the end of my time there, I was we'd finished all our exams when we were in the sixth form, and we were still at school for a little while. They didn't know quite what to do with us, so they decided that one of the things we would do was produce a play, and I actually played the lead in The Ghost Train at school, which was written, of course, by Arnold Ridley, who I was later to meet hundreds of years later as Private Godfrey in Dad's Army.
Yeah, which is an incredible coincidence.
Well, I don't know if it's that much of a coincidence, because The Ghost Train is probably one of the most popular plays amateurs. So if you were going to meet Arnold Ridley, quite likely you'd have had something to do with The Ghost Train at some point in your career. I mean, since we finished Dad's Army, I mean, Ian Lavender, for instance, has been out on tour in The Ghost Train, yes. I know. Yeah. So there we are.
Presumably, when you became very aware that you wanted to pursue acting for a living, I mean, you hear lots of stories from actors saying, oh, and I told my parents, and they put their heads in their hands, and they thought, oh, no. But that wasn't the case with you.
Not really, no. I mean, I had this illusion that I wanted to be a boy actor, because, you know, I'd been to the cinema a lot, and I'd seen people like Mickey Rooney and so on. I thought, well, I could do that. I could be there and be a boy actor. And my parents did rather put their heads in their hands and say, no, 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 you can finish your schooling first. So I dutifully did that, and then they were very supportive about it, which was amazing in a way, because we'd no theatrical background in our family, so it was a sort of new phenomenon for them, but totally. They were supportive.
And they were very supportive in terms of sponsoring you to become ASM?
The Gateway. Gateway, yes. It was one, I suppose, like a sort of fringe theatre of its day. It was in Westbourne Grove in London, and I went there as a student ASM. My father had to pay £30, which I suppose was a reasonable amount of money in those days, for me to go there, and I got it back at the rate of £2 a week for 15 weeks. When the 15 weeks were over, they actually kept me on, and at £2 a week, I think cheap labour, I suppose, and it did actually get put up to £3 at one point, and then they went on to a profit share thing, which always meant you got a little envelope saying there are no profits, but and you owe the bar 2 and 6 pence, you know.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting way to pay you, by sending you bills.
Yes, yes.
There was a story of strange coincidence whilst you're at the Gateway with the national anthem, where I understand that you played the French.
I was in charge of playing the recording system over there, and we always played the national anthem at the beginning of a play, and the audience all stood up. I mean, we're going back now to the early 1950s, and the audience all stood up and before the play began, and it was my thing to put the record on. Old days of old 78 RPM records, no tapes or anything like that, or CDs or any of the modern things we have. And so I used to go and put this 78 record on, National Anthems of All the Nations, and one of the times I was, I think, playing something in the play, you know, so I was in the dressing room getting made up, and suddenly it came for the bit for the national anthem, so I dashed there, grabbed the record, and obviously put the wrong side on, because out came the Marseillaise. I must say, the audience actually all stood up beautifully and probably looked round to see where the French ambassador was or something like that. But so I thought I'd let them get away with it. Let him get on with it.
Did you ever mention that to Jimmy or David? Because something very similar happens in one of their episodes, A Soldier's Farewell.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about the similarity of that, but no, I don't think I ever did. But yes, of course, that's a wonderful one, isn't it? Where he's disgusted that they all rush out of the cinema.
Absolutely.
At the end of the film, when the national anthem is played, and then he sort of puts them through it by keeping playing the national anthem, and I think Mary and I are disputing over the desk, aren't we?
You are at the same time.
That's right. Every time the national anthem ends, we do a scrabble to see who can get in the chair first.
Yes, which is one of the genuine scenes that people do remember. But of course, at the same time, that's interplay with the the national anthem being speeded up because they particularly want to sit there and listen to it completely.
Yes, yes.
But no, as soon as I read that story in your autobiography, I wondered whether or not you'd given an idea to the writers.
I don't know, but I don't remember ever mentioning it to either David or Jimmy, but there we are.
Well, there you go. Going back again to your early career, moving on from the original acting roles that you got in your role as ASM, the natural move on for that was films and film extras.
I did quite a lot of work as a film extra. I defended the castle and attacked the castle in Ivanhoe a great deal, I seem to remember. Different uniform, of course.
Sure.
A cast of thousands, which was just as well, because, you know, I was never very good at firing a bow and arrow or anything like that. My arrow sort of did a little arc in the air and went into the row in front of me. But fortunately, I'm probably right at the back of about 1,000 people, so nobody would notice my arrow doing the wrong thing. A lot of other people's arrows were doing it as well.
Now, I can imagine there's a vast difference between acting on a stage, which is what you were used to, to going onto a huge film set with, as you say, a cast of thousands.
Yeah, well, as an extra, I mean, in those days, I mean, one was just sort of, well, literally that, an extra standing around in the right sort of costume, but you didn't actually have to do a great deal of acting. And it was a fascinating thing. The thing was, one met such a wonderful cross-section of people. I mean, in those days, the people who did crowd work had a special union. They weren't members of Equity. They were members of a union called the Film Artists Association. And that contained absolutely everything from people who just come out of Borstal to people who'd been at Eton and everything between, and it was a marvellous cross-section of people, so it was a very enjoyable thing to do in many ways.
Sure. So how did you make the transition then from going from film extra over to, in some films, a very major role?
Well, I think I began to realise that if you were going to be a film extra, you'd get known as a film extra and you'd always be a film extra. So with some regret I stopped doing film extra work and started to try and get some work as a proper actor in films. And my first film I did was a religious film called Shield of Faith, in which I played a soldier dying in the First World War. And but that was a film, a sort of private film for the rank religious films department. But then the first proper feature film I did was a thing called The Extra Day, which, funnily enough, was set in a film studio, and I played an assistant cameraman. So I've got photographs of myself sitting on the camera, the camera crane, with Brian Forbes, no less. He was the chief assistant director in the playing the part of an assistant director in the film. So it's very fascinating in a way.
You mentioned Brian Forbes there. I mean, you've also starred with Norman Wisdom, I understand.
Oh, I did several films with Norman Wisdom. The first film, The Square Peg, funnily enough, I didn't meet him, because the scene is, and we're talking to each other on the end of a field telephone. And he, of course, filmed his one day, and I filmed mine the other, with somebody else reading his words. But so it looks as though we're having a scene together, but on that occasion we never met. But I did several other films with him, The Bulldog Breed, Stitch in Time, and I think one other one. And I was a lovely guy. I mean, Norman is one of my favourite people. He's a great character.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who you watch on a film on celluloid and you think, yes, I think that's almost the kind of person he would portray in real life. Very jolly character.
Yes.
Again, always performing, but it's, yeah.
Of course, you do get some comedians who are really very miserable characters in real life, but certainly that didn't apply to Norman. He is a really, really nice guy, and the fun to be with and full of enthusiasm.
Yeah, he certainly comes across as enthusiastic, certainly. Yeah. You've always also dabbled in writing. There's been a couple of things, and I believe one of your scripts actually led to close contact with Jimmy Perry.
Jimmy Perry, at the time when I'm going back along in the early days of my career, Jimmy Perry was running the Repertory Theatre at Watford, and long before I went into the business myself, as a schoolboy, I always used to go every week to see the new play at Watford. And then when I went into the business, I said I'd like to. I wrote to Jimmy and said, I'm an actor, and I did a couple of plays for him, and I asked him if he'd be interested in reading a play that I'd written, which he did. It was a play called The TV Murders, and it was about a group of people in a boarding house sitting around watching television in the early days of television, and they're watching in the dark, and when the lights come up, one of them's been stabbed in the back, really good stuff. And Jimmy did this in the Repertory Theatre at Watford. And I also wrote a religious play, which I sort of put on myself there with support from Jimmy. And to Jimmy's surprise, we actually did extremely well because I worked very, very hard on the publicity. And Jimmy and I became really quite good friends. And I became chairman of the supporters club at Watford. Watford Theatre, that is, not the football club. He and I got to know each other very well. And I think it was through that, actually, his memories of that, that I got the part in Dad's Army. So you never know what things you do in this year may actually bear fruit several years later.
Absolutely. That play you mentioned was called The Substitute, was it not?
The Substitute, that's right. That was a religious play. I originally wrote that for my local council of churches to do, one Easter, and they did, and then I thought, I'd really like to see this done professionally, so we did it professionally at Watford.
Before we move on to the Dad's Army element of your career, the other plays that you've written all strangely seem to have murder in a title.
They don't all have, but all my thrillers have murder in the title, because I was told that it's very good for the box office. I gather you actually increase your ticket sales if you've got the word murder in the title.
Well, that's worrying,
it's a great sort of thing of in the English theatrical and reading thing, that kind of detective story. It has always been very, very popular. I mean, you go back to Dorothy Sayers, Agatha Christie, and now we've got PDJ, Ruth Rendell, and so on. So it's always been a real feature.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But of course, at that time, I was in another very, very, I suppose one of the most popular television programmes of its, well, it was, I think we were always in the top 10, was called The Army Game for Granada Television, which was done in the, I don't know quite when it was done, but I was in it from about 1959 to 1961. I was in it for 2.5 years, and I did more episodes of that in 2.5 years than I did in the entire time of Dad's Army. Because we used to do, with the Army Game, we used to do one a week live television, 39 weeks in the year, have a 30-week break, and then go back and do another 39. So, it was very hard work, but it was enormously popular. I mean, it was the show that actually brought me, recognition in the street. People used to come up and stop me in the street, because it was a very, very popular show.
Colonel Pocket, is that correct?
Captain Pocket.
Captain. Thank you
for increasing my rank, but I was only a captain.
No, I remember, and that also starred William Hartnell, I believe.
Originally it was William Hartnell, although by the time I did several sort of odd episodes before I went into it permanently. By the time I went into it permanently, William Hartnell had left, and Bill Fraser was playing the sergeant, Sergeant Major Snudge. And then the very last series I did of that, Bill Fraser left with Alfie Bass to do a programme called Bootsy and Snudge. They did another series of the Army Game without them, and we had William Hartnell came back for that. So,
right.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, and William Hartnell, of course, famous for playing the very first Doctor Who.
The very first Doctor Who, yes.
1963, that was.
Do you know, I've never been in a Doctor Who. I think that's a very big lack. I should have been in a Doctor Who.
I was going to say, as some listeners will know, I'm very keen on Doctor Who as well. So,
yes.
Of course, I'm interested in your association with Nicholas Courtney, but I think we probably would be getting off the subject a little bit. I'd have to start a Doctor Who podcast before I talk about that. But, moving on to the role I think it's fairly true to say you're the most famous for. Which is the
Vicar. I suppose it is, yes. The Vicar. Everybody says the Vicar. Everybody knows the Vicar.
Is that a little bit draining at times? Because
no,
you
not
think
at all. Well, in a way, I mean, I'd like to be taken seriously as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had a chance to play various straight parts, mainly, some on television, but... I did three plays out at the English Theatre in Vienna, where, not surprisingly, for various reasons, Dad's Army is not known at all. And, and I'm allowed to be serious there, so I did two plays by Simon Gray, otherwise engaged and stage struck, and then I played the father in Terence Rattigan's The Winslow Boy. And that gives me a chance to be taken seriously. Mm. So I suppose the one thing I regret about my constant association with comedy, not just Dad's Army, but anything else, is that it does sort of rather militate against people taking me seriously.
Yes.
But having said that, I wouldn't have missed being in Dad's Army for anything, because it was certainly the happiest period of my life. It was the most wonderful show to be in.
Mm.
And I don't think any of us dreamt that 40 years on now, it would still be being shown, still have a wonderful fan base. I mean, we have a Dad's Army Day in Bressingham every year. There's a museum, a steam museum there, which has got an enormous sort of hangar place devoted to Dad's Army. And... when we go up there, it is amazing to find the great age range of the fans. I mean, you've got grandparents there with their grandchildren, and both the grandparents and the grandchildren are fans. And I mean, that is marvellous.
It is. It's pretty much unique, I think.
Yeah, and of course with the repeats they show, with the repeats on some of the digital channels, with DVDs, with tapes and so on. I mean, we're just getting an entirely new audience. I mean, quite a lot of most of the people that come up, or the young people that come up, weren't even born when we did it. So there we are.
It's true with the listeners of the podcasts. We get emails from 13 and 14-year-olds.
Dare I say it, you probably weren't born when we did it.
Was I born? Yeah, I was born, just about. It is one of the programme's strengths, I think, its ability to attract fans and viewers across the age ranges. And as you say, it's coming up on its 40th anniversary, and the BBC showing season 6 again at the moment. Each Saturday, it's got a semi-regular spot.
Yes.
So it's doing very well.
Yes, it's doing very well indeed, yes. I'm really very pleased about that.
Within the programme, the way the Vicar eventually developed, and he got larger roles, more lines, and so on. When you first were offered the part, did you understand that it was just going to be that one episode, or potentially two, three?
No, as far as I knew, I was just... they rang me up and said, there's this programme called Dad's Army, and we'd like you as a character of a vicar. He's only got a couple of lines, I'm afraid, but would you like to come and do it? I said, week's work, jolly good. And I'd worked for David Croft before, because I did Hugh and I for him, I think, and probably something else. And then Jimmy, of course, I'd known from Watford, as I said, so I thought I was going to be with chums anyway. So, yeah, I was delighted to do it, and I went on and I did my couple of lines, and I thought, that was very enjoyable, and didn't think any more about it. Then week or two later, they rang me and said, well, we'd like to bring the Vicar out in another episode. And, and so it grew and grew. And by the time we did the last series, I think I was in every episode of
series. Yes. Yeah, every one. I mean, presumably you've seen the first two series now, which presumably, you know, you weren't in. The Vicar was referenced in a couple of those episodes.
Yes, he was indeed, yes. Yeah. I mean, Edward Sinclair, who played the Verger, went in much earlier than I did. And I think there were quite a number of references to his reverence this and his reverence that.
That's right. So his reverence just never made an appearance until series three. And Edward Sinclair was also the caretaker, or he was referred to as the caretaker in the early episodes rather than the Verger.
Oh, was he? Oh, right, I forgot that. But not sure I even knew that, but there we are.
When you were recording within a studio, you were performing in front of an audience as well.
Yes.
Very much in line with how some television comedies are recorded today. What was it like performing in front of a TV audience instead of a theatre audience? Was there a significant difference?
I'm not sure, really. I think there was to some extent, because you also had to be aware of things like camera angles and where you were, and also the fact that it's a difficult one, this. I never quite know what the answer to it is. I think instinctively one does something slightly different, but I can't quite put my finger on what it is, because you have to be aware that you're playing to the studio audience, but you have to be aware that your prime thing is playing to the audience who are sitting at home. I think perhaps one is less aware of the audience when you're doing a TV comedy, although of course you have to be aware of them because you're hearing them laugh, hopefully. And so you have to be timing to their laughs as well. And of course the other thing is now, as I said, when I did the Army Game, they were all live television. Now, when we were doing Dad's Army, everything was recorded. So, point of fact, I mean, it could be edited afterwards. And, I mean, I think some of the genius of some of the Dad's Army programmes is the way they're edited, the way they're shot. For instance, when Clive goes into one of his internal stories about the Fuzzy Wuzzies or whatever, and you keep cutting to shots of Arthur Lowe's reaction to it. I mean, that actually makes the magic of the whole thing.
I agree. It's something we've talked about before, is the reaction shot. It almost adds to the line that's...
It does indeed, yes. It actually makes it. I mean, I think if you watch some of these things without any of those reactions... It probably wouldn't be half as funny.
It's different. Yes. It's different, and I've tried to do that. And Ian Lavender's spoken about this on a couple of the DVDs.
Has he? Yes.
And he said in particular in the most famous episode, The Deadly Attachments, where he's up the stepladder.
Yes.
And the famous line's been said, don't tell him, Pike.
Yeah.
Apparently he pleaded with David not to come to him for a reaction shot because he couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah.
And if you look carefully at that scene, you can actually see Ian biting his lip at that point. But it's a fantastic way. And I actually think that's one of the problems in transferring the televisual format to the most recent stage play.
Yeah.
It's one of the flaws I didn't get round. Was because, of course, you don't realise how much the reaction humour is part of the television programme, and you can't translate that onto stage.
Well, on a television programme, of course, the camera says, this is what we want you to look at. You've got a stage, you've got all the people there, you don't know...
Yeah.
You probably are looking at the person who's speaking.
Mm.
And you may glance across and see some actor on the stage doing a wonderful reaction, but it isn't the same as the camera saying to you, don't look at him, look at him now.
Yeah, and it's remarkable how noticeable that is at times as well. So.
I have to say, I haven't seen the new stage production, but of course we did our own stage production, which was a musical, so...
Of course, this was 1976, I think.
1976, absolutely. No, wait a minute, I think we were in the West End in 75 and we did the tour in 76.
Okay.
Or I may have got it wrong, but I think I've got it right. And, we had 6 months in the West End and then 6 months on tour. The 6 months on tour were during that sort of summer where we had the biggest heat wave for a long, long time. I mean, and I can remember, you know, being exhausted, but it was the most marvellous experience. I mean, it really was. It was, again, a very happy time. The thing about Dad's Army is all my memories of it are happy ones. You know, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing in all its ways of coming out.
Well, it's terrific. And when you see the programme, people always say it's got a warmth to it.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's got to be amongst the actors there in order to transmit it. So it's got to be quite a talent to transmit that kind of warmth if it didn't exist.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 75-76 tour.
Yes.
Stage play. That's when, of course, you purchased your cine camera. Your 16.
I did indeed.
Which
yes.
Well, very recently have actually seen your footage.
Oh, you have on the latest DVD.
Yeah, that's the first time I've seen it.
Yes, yes. There it was. I mean, I think it's quite funny. I mean, as you know, it's on the most recent BBC release. I think it's the final one they're releasing, isn't it?
Yep.
With the Christmas specials on it. And of course it does just give a little bit of insight to life off stage with because you see, as I said, it was that glorious summer, so we were doing the show in the evening, but during the day we were out and about enjoying enjoying the sunshine, enjoying the thing. So I think there's some shots in that of there's some shots in Blackpool, which I don't think was remarkable weather, but I think that was quite early in the year. But then there are shots of us wandering around Longleat, I think, and
and
at the seaside on one or two occasions. Yeah, I think a lot of people have said how interesting they found that little bit of film.
It's one of the gems on the disc.
Yeah, and of course I added my own little commentary to it, thanks to the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, who organised that for me, and Ralph Montague took the footage, and BBC, I don't know, cleaned it up, not in the sense of a sexual thing, you know, but made the pictures clearer.
Well, it has got pictures of Bill Pertwee without a shirt on. So.
Yeah, yes, yes, yes. No,
but I found that a fascinating piece of film. And one of the questions I was going to ask you is whether, you know, how recently you recorded that narration over the top.
Oh, probably. When you get to my age, it all goes together a bit. You can't quite remember how long it... I would say 5-6 years, perhaps more ago.
Some time ago, then.
Yeah, well, yes, it must be at least 5 or 6 years. I would say 10 years, because I can remember... I think it was two men, Paul Carpenter and Tony Pritchard, coming round from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society. And we put this film, which they had transferred onto video... and watched it on my old television set, and I sat in front of it, and they had a recorder there, and I just recorded the commentary off the top of my head as I was watching this film on my old television set. So there you are.
Wonderful, wonderful. It is superb. One of the questions I have to ask you, I mean, you've probably been asked this 100 times, if not more, what's your favourite Dad's Army episode, or do you have one even?
I think there are two. One would have to be The Royal Train. And I watched that the other night, and I still think it's got some wonderful stuff in it. I think I enjoyed that. The location filming for Dad's Army was absolutely lovely. I mean, it seemed to be idyllic weather always, and we would go up to Norfolk and do these location shots for the entire 6 or 7 episodes that were going to be in that particular series. And I remember the day when we were doing The Royal Train. I mean, it was a bit hair-raising at times. That bit where the train is actually chasing us, and we're on that pump carriage thing trying to keep in front of them. I mean, it was quite scary. And I remember Bill saying, they're gaining on us, and, you know, if they catch us, they'll crash into us, and we'll all be thrown to smithereens or something.
but
all was well. And I suppose my other favourite one was the day the balloon went up.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was fun. I can remember sort of marching across the fields holding on to this barrage balloon. And no, I'm not going to say what was written on the back of the harmonium.
Oh, well, I've got to cross out my next question. I can imagine it was not as colourful as we are led to believe.
I don't think we ever really knew. I mean, I was the vicar, was kept certainly the other side of the harmonium, so I never got a look round the back.
Well, you certainly looked very
shocked,
affronted, certainly, yes. Yeah, the vicar role is extended into many other series, and you played members of the clergy in Your Angry Lord and other series as well. I mean, how did you feel about this propensity to offer you roles that were within the church?
Well, it's this thing called typecasting, isn't it? When I did the Army Game way back in the 1959-1961, I played a rather silly-ass officer in the Army. And at that time, people got the idea that all I did was play silly-ass officers. I mean, I remember going to see a casting director of film, and he said, "I don't know why you've come to see me. We haven't got any soldiers in this film." And I thought, it'd be ridiculous. I'm an actor, you know. I could play a crook or a gangster or something. Mm. But then Dad's Army came up, and you know, the vicar was, as I say, it was the happiest days of my life, and I really, really loved that. I then got a chance to play a few other vicars. I mean, I actually performed Ruth Maddock's marriage in Heidi High,
yeah.
And I played an archdeacon in, not the most recent, but a television serial of Vanity Fair. And then, of course, Jimmy and David themselves promoted me to bishop in Your Angry Lord.
Yes.
And I must say, I love playing the bishop in Your Angry Lord. And I love doing Your Angry Lord. Actually, I think that is a very underrated programme. I think I don't think it's underrated by those who've seen it. They love it. But somehow the BBC have never repeated it. But there we are.
Anyway, Frank, thank you very much indeed for spending the time speaking to us.
Be very enjoyable. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much indeed. Perhaps we'll talk to you again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to do it again one day. We'll talk about things we haven't talked about this time.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'd just like to say thank you ever so much to Frank Williams, who gave a wonderful interview, made the job of interviewing him very, very easy, which is just as well, given how amateur I am interviewing. I was also very starstruck. I'd seen Frank on television for years, and I was very nervous, asking him lots of questions about his career, and he was exceptionally generous with his time. I strongly recommend that you take a read, if you haven't already, of Frank's autobiography, which is called Vicar to Dad's Army. It's available on Play and on Amazon.co.uk for about £10, and it's one of those autobiographies that you can actually hear the actor voice throughout the pages. It's exceptionally interesting. It's a little bit sad. It made me laugh out loud sometimes in places, and it's a wonderful account of Frank's life to date. So once again, thanks ever so much to Frank for the time that you spent with me. Thanks also must go to Paul Carpenter of the Dad's Army Appreciation Society, who made the interview possible. Podcast 16 will be out in a couple of weeks' time, where we'll have part 2 of the feature that Tony and I started last podcast, which was where we were examining the special features on the Christmas Specials DVD, and also we'll be talking about Branded. So any comments on either of those two areas, either the DVD or Branded, please send in to us at warmingtononc333@yahoo.co.uk. And until next time, goodbye.